I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Hashtag MeToo, an international movement of women and some men in solidarity around their encounters with men who harass, molest, and assault them. But does MeToo have a diversity problem? And from prominent women like the author Margaret Atwood and journalist Caitlin Flanagan, questions about due process and whether the movement is animated by animus towards men in general. Our conversation today, inclusivity and the movement for women's empowerment. My guests, Adar Ayira of Associated Black Charities, Dr. Kimberly Moffitt of the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and Alize Jalisi, a student at Johns Hopkins University who is the president of Hopkins Feminists. Plus, J. Wynn Russick reviews a production of Leonard Bernstein's Trouble in Tahiti at Baltimore's Still Point Theater. That's all coming up on Midday, right after these headlines. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad that you have joined us today. When actress Alyssa Milano tweeted the words "Me Too" at the peak of the Harvey Weinstein sexual assault scandal last October, the response from women around the globe was immediate. In 24 hours, her message had garnered tens of thousands of views and shares across Twitter. Me Too had become a beacon for women to rally around and share their stories of sexual abuse and harassment. To date, hashtag MeToo has been shared in over 90 countries and has been tweeted over 6.5 million times and counting. As the hashtag gathered steam and allegations of sexual assault and harassment led to the resignation of a number of high-profile, powerful men, criticism of the campaign soon followed. Recently, French actress Catherine Deneuve described the campaign as new puritanism and a witch hunt. Celebrated Canadian author Margaret Atwood echoed a similar sentiment about Me Too, calling out the lack of due process for men who are accused of these crimes. And then there is also the question of diversity. For a little while, when the Weinstein story broke, hashtag Me Too was credited as being the brainchild of Ms. Milano, when in actuality it had been created years prior by a black activist named Tarana Burke, a decade before Harvey Weinstein's assaults were brought to light. Black women like Burke and Anita Hill have long led the charge for rights for victims of sexual assault, yet the voices of black women are often diminished in these conversations. Does the global movement have a diversity problem? I'm joined in Studio A today by Adar Ayira. She's a poet, an artist, and an anti-racism facilitator. She is part of the senior leadership team at Associated Black Charities and one of the co-founders of Baltimore Racial Justice Action and a regular commentator on our program. Adar, it's nice to see you.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Kimberly Moffitt is an assistant professor of American Studies and Africana Studies in Language, Literacy, and Culture at UMBC and another longtime friend of our program. Good to see you, Kimberly.
Thank you.
And Alize Jalisi is here as well. She's a senior at Johns Hopkins University and the president of Hopkins Feminists. Alize, it's nice to meet you. Thanks for coming.
Nice to meet you, too.
To be part of our conversation here on Midday, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So let's talk first about this issue of inclusivity and where the Me Too movement and the feminist movement in general stands. Adar Ayira, when you think of the Me Too movement, do you think of it as being inclusive?
No. In one word.
To put it succinctly.
You know, it is. A friend of mine said to me this morning that when we start talking on these topics, we generally start in the middle. We do not start at the beginning. And when I think of a whole 400-year history of sexual abuse being condoned, of rape and particularly rape of black women and other women of color being condoned, and America has not had issue with that. We look at the case of Recy Taylor, who just died, Miss Taylor just died, who had to wait so many years for justice when everyone knew her white assailants and no one cared about that. So we are in the middle of something that has been created, condoned from back to inception, and we need to put this within the context of those stories and not just start at a 2017 tweet from Miss Milano and act as if that's the beginning of the story or the movement.
Yeah, and Kimberly Moffitt, a lot of folks have commented that the earliest pioneers of sexual harassment outing, of you know, involvement in getting rights for victims of sexual harassment, some of the earliest people involved in this historically were Black women inspired by the civil rights movement. So this did not start with Harvey Weinstein.
No, not at all. And I think what we're seeing is what has continuously happened, whether it's media related or whether it's related to health disparities research, that once again, we're seeing the invisibility or the erasure of Black and brown bodies from conversations that are very much about societal ills, and that they are impacting all of us, but yet that all of us seems to always look like and appear to be a particular color.
Who's responsible for that?
We all are. But I think there are even more specific groups of people that we can talk about who are responsible for that. But I think, again, you know, when we do this erasing of bodies, we also silence those voices attached to the bodies. And so oftentimes, even if I am speaking, it's not being heard because of the very body it comes from. And so that silence means that my stories, my narratives aren't being heard while others are being shared and appear to be what is the dominant and more central component of a discussion. And so Melissa Milano, it makes sense to us that she would be someone that folks are listening to. She happens to look a particular
way.
She's
a celebrity.
She's a celebrity. Yeah. I mean, all of these things work in her favor to be someone that people would pay attention to and say, wait a minute, here are some of my experiences, and I know a number of other people that look like me that have them as well, without recognizing that it's much larger than that one segment of the population.
And Alize Jalisi, you're the president of Hopkins Feminists. Mm-hmm. You're senior over at Hopkins. What is the mission of your organization? What do you see your role, and what are the aspirations for what you'd like to accomplish?
So our group is an intersectional feminist group, and our goal is to advocate and raise awareness for gender equity and liberation from traditional gender roles on campus and off campus as well. So we have weekly meetings, which are open to the entire Hopkins community and the public as well. And in addition to that, we also have programming, which is often done in conjunction with other student groups or organizations. Like I said, we try to have an intersectional focus. So that means that, you know, we try our best not to treat the fight for gender equity as a single issue. We try to address other aspects of identity that affect a person's experience, and their, in particular, their gendered experience. So, for example, racism, xenophobia, in particular, transphobia, and so on and so forth.
So race is part of the mix for what you're doing. I mean, one part of a very large mix of various dimensions.
Mm-hmm, without a doubt.
Yeah. And Adar Ayer, there are a number of historians who have cited the civil rights movement as the inspiration for the women's movement, for the environmental movement, for the gay rights movement, for, you know, Occupy Wall Street. I mean, for a number of movements, you know, the inspiration comes from Dr. King and the civil rights struggles of the 60s. And there are others who are saying, but the feminist movement, the Me Too movement, has appropriated the civil rights struggle of people of color for the goals of women and in that gender lens. What do you think about that?
I think that they're right. And I think that every movement, to a certain extent, to a certain degree, has appropriated from that movement. And I want to be clear here, because people always point to the King movement, the third phase of the civil rights movement, as if it is the only one. And there have been different phases of the civil rights movement, and that was just one of a long trajectory that is continuing now. One very disturbing thing about the quote unquote women's movement is that the women's movement has always been whiteness focused, mm-hmm. and it has always been cisgendered, mm-hmm. and it has always been classist, right? Mm-hmm. That they focused on the concerns of middle income women. So when we talk about it as if it is a universalist phrase and a universalist movement, we are once again doing what Dr. Moffitt is talking about, which is erasing the other types of voices and experiences who are more at risk than any white middle-income woman is. Mm-hmm. And we are centering them as being somehow in the most danger. And again, not to start the story in the middle, but to take the story back to the beginning. In this country, in white supremacy, in a patriarchy, white women have always been used as both a reward and a bludgeon to oppress men of color. And we should not forget that, nor should the women's, quote unquote, the white feminist movement forget that. Because when they do, then they too become part of that which they say they want to dismantle. And what they're really saying then is, I just want my piece of it. Mm-hmm.
And Kimberly Moffitt, I mean, is it
I
a bad...
I don't feel like there's much for me to add to this, Tom.
But... Yeah, well, let me do this. And this is not by way of pushing back, because I totally agree with Adar's analysis of the middle-class whiteness of the feminist movement. When you think about the feminism of the 60s and 70s, you think Gloria Steinem. You don't think Angela Davis.
Right.
You
know? Right.
But because you think Angela Davis in terms of racial equity.
Right.
You don't think about Angela Davis or her many sisters in that struggle as being gender equality focused. Is it just that the burden for black women has just been so enormous when you've got both the gender side and the racial side to deal with, that did they have to choose, or did white women, you know, actively exclude because there was no sisterhood, for lack of a better phrase? You know, there was no commonality in the struggle.
Yes. No, I think, you know, when we are dealing with intersectionality, I always teach and talk about the fact that you can't separate those, the intersections of who you're and what your identity is, whether it is sexual orientation, class, race, gender, etc. All of those things make up who you are. And so to try and pluck one and say this one is the one that has the most significant value actually doesn't work. But we do it because human beings have a hard time being able to figure out how to conflate or deal with all of these identities at once. And because something like race of brown and black bodies is so much more visible, that becomes the go-to, that I then can look at the women in this room and say they are black and brown women and not have to then focus on them being women or focus on the gendered aspect of it. But that becomes problematic because, again, you're leaving out the voices of other women who also have something to contribute to the Me Too movement, the women's movement, feminism, etc. But yet that gets left out because we're only thinking about a particular group of women. And white supremacy does play a role in that, mm-hmm. a significant role, mm-hmm. where, I mean, we can look just a year ago at the presidential campaign and election in this country to see who actually helped to ensure that Donald Trump would serve as our president for the next 4 years. Why? Because there is value in holding on to a systemic process or system of oppression that benefits some groups and doesn't benefit others or excludes others. And I think that's what we saw.
But of course, just for the record, if more black and brown women and men and more progressive women, white women on the left had voted, mm-mm. instead of staying home, mm-mm. our election might have
okay, so
because when you make an analysis of an election and we target white women, mm-hmm. and believe me, they got some targeting due to them. But on the other hand, elections are choices. As one black activist once famously said, elections are not Valentines, they're chess moves. So there are all sorts of people who were disturbed by Hillary Clinton for this reason or the other reason. They wanted Bernie Sanders or blah, 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 and they stayed home.
But let me just throw this in. You cannot talk about people staying home. You cannot talk about people not voting without talking about the gutting of certain aspects of the Voting Rights Act, which made it harder for people to come to the polls. So again, we cannot start in the middle of the story. We have to start at the beginning. And this presidential election was the first election since that happened. And we saw the outcomes of that, as we are seeing outcomes in different states and cities that are trying to be gerrymandered to help exclude those black and brown and other non-black people of color voices in this country.
Point well taken, and we will pick that up when we come back from a break. Adar Ayira of Associated Black Charities and Baltimore Racial Justice Action, UMBC Professor Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, and Alize Jalisi. She's the president of Hopkins Feminists. They are my guests this afternoon here on Midday. We're talking about the Me Too movement. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday at WIPR.org. Our Twitter handle, at Midday Tom Hall. Around. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, it's the Friday Midday News Wrap. Ron Elving, he's the senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk for NPR, joins me to review the week's top national and international stories, from the government shutdown and the weekend's women's marches to the latest developments in the Russia probe and the president's pitch to the World Economic Forum in Davos. Then Baltimore Sun editorial page editor Andy Green and Bishop Douglas Miles of Koinonia Baptist Church help us sort out the mayor's shakeup of the police department here in Baltimore, as well as other local news developments. So hope you can join us for the Midday News Wrap. That's coming up tomorrow at this hour. Coming up a little later today, our weekly review with theater critic Jay Wynn Russick. She's going to tell us about Trouble in Tahiti at the Still Point Theater. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about the Me Too movement, which has given voice to survivors of sexual assault and abuse around the world. My guests today, UMBC Professor Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, Adar Ayira of Associated Black Charities, and Alize Jalisi, the president of Hopkins Feminists. You are welcome to be part of our conversation. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday at WIPR.org, and our Twitter handle, at Midday Tom Hall. Let me try to get a couple of phone calls here. Umar in Annapolis, welcome to Midday. Thanks for calling.
Hi there.
Hi, what's on your mind?
So I had a question specifically for Alize Jalisi. I was wondering what roles can men play to help in the Me Too and the Times Up movement. We've seen in the James Franco case, and when he was coming up to speak as well, where he's a staunch supporter of the Me Too and Times Up movement. However, there have been many women accusing him as well of this. And so I wanted to touch specifically on the intersectionality of that, of how what role men can play in this movement.
All right, thanks for the call, Umar. Alize, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question that I've certainly been thinking about recently. And so I would really, advocate that men and male-identifying individuals really think deeply and reflect on how they've been raised to cater to and endorse and perform traditional masculinity and what that allows. Like, I personally believe that it's inherent to masculinity or norms of masculinity to be allowed to perform gender violence and take advantage of women and female-identifying individuals and non-binary and trans folks. So I think, it's really important for men everywhere to think about how that male privilege plays into their gendered interactions every single day and how they approach gendered relationships. And doing more than just, wearing a Time's Up pin and posting, I support like Me Too survivors. I think really having active conversations with other men about what you can do and, believing survivors and trusting them and advocating for them and centering their experiences, with gender-based violence is imperative. And also recognizing that these movements, like we've brought up in, earlier, you know, have their limitations. They are classist, they are white-centered, and they're cisgender-centered. So thinking about how those, you know, how those obstacles can play a role into the oppression that men propagate, I think is really important.
Kimberly Moffitt, one of the producers on our staff, a woman who is neither a millennial nor a senior citizen, somewhere in between, makes a point. Her name's Kathleen Cahill, a colleague and good friend. She says, you know, looking at these things through a gendered lens is to a certain extent what got us as a society into this mess. Mm. You know, she makes the point, if a man says, you don't get to assault me, that's like just understood. Then the guy's, you know, standing up for himself, right? But when a woman says, you don't get to assault me, all of a sudden she's a feminist. Mm. I mean, where does that stand?
No, I think her point is well taken. I mean, if we just look historically of the role that women have played in society, and even as, you know, the idea that women were seen more as property than they were as companions with their male spouses, that already creates a society where you think there's superiority of one gender versus another. And so I think what we're experiencing are just continuous evolution and growing pains for a society that's moving away further and further from its beginnings to say women are not these separate entities that can be looked upon or acted upon, but they have to be engaged like any other human being would be. I think that's one of the key differences of what we're experiencing now.
I know one of the little things that I talk to my men friends about, what little steps we can make. I try to avoid the phrase, I don't always get to avoid it, but I've been married for 32 years, but I try to avoid the phrase "my wife." It just sounds like, as you're saying, this thing that I own. You know, Linnell is the love of my life, but you know, and she is my wife in that we are married. You know, and I am her husband, and right. So we belong to each other in that sense. But there's something about that rhetoric that
I hope she's listening.
That I can never guarantee. She gets a mouthful and an earful of this at home, so she may take a break at noon. I don't know. But you know, when it comes to believability of victims, Adar Ayira, we have Margaret Atwood, another prominent white woman, writing in the Globe and Mail in Canada. She's a Canadian author, about an incident at the University of British Columbia in Canada. A professor named Stephen Galloway, it was brought to light that he had been accused of sexual assault before an inquiry was made. After the inquiry was concluded, the judge decided there had been no sexual assault, but he was fired anyway. And Margaret Atwood says that one of the things that happens is that it sort of infantilizes women. She says, I don't believe women are children incapable of agency and making moral decisions. You know, the women involved in this are not the victims to the extent that they had... they had options, you know, and people have reacted to the Aziz Ansari situation in the same way. This woman could have called a cab, called an Uber, hopped on the subway, and just gotten herself out of there. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
So I think that one of the first things that we need to do in having these conversations is to differentiate between those things that can be personal hurts and those things that are structural oppression. And I think that if we did that, it would help us in having these types of conversations, right? That's number one. Number two, getting to believability, we cannot separate the whole issue of gender and sexual assault from the issue of race, because that does get to not only the issue of believability, but the issue of whose bodies count, the issue of whose assaults count, the issue of whose oppression or perceived oppression counts. And we try to silo these issues because it is as uncomfortable as all of these conversations are. It is more comfortable to address a conversation which impacts all women, quote unquote, than it is to go deeper into the conversations about whose bodies count, whose assaults count, who are believable, because that brings in race and historically how Black and brown women's bodies have been thought to be available for use without retribution in a way that white women's bodies were not. And as a society, we have not grappled with that yet. We have not grappled with the history, with the continuing impacts, and with what it says about us today.
How do we grapple with that? What is grappling with that look like?
Grappling with that means that, again, we can't just have the conversation starting in the middle. We have to go back to the beginning and to face our history, and not only the history of how African descendant and other non-Black women of color have been positioned and used in American society, but also how white women have been positioned and used in American society, and also how violence has been gendered, even whose pain, whose hurts, whose assaults count there. You know, if you have a man who is a rape victim or victimized in another way, that is going to be a different conversation than it would be for a woman. So we have to look at all of those things and look at it within the context of history and within the ways in which America has codified it, has codified masculinity and white masculinity in America. And we never have that conversation either.
Mm-hmm. A couple of comments, speaking of who we talk about and how we talk about them. This comes from Anne, an email, who says, "Find it interesting that you're talking about only white people and Black and brown people. You should talk about white supremacy and you don't talk about Black supremacy. There are people in our culture, in our world, that are not white or Black or brown. You have not addressed Native American people. You haven't addressed Asian people." She makes that point also. This is a person who wishes to remain anonymous, signs it an abused senior. This is another email. "It's important not to forget elderly abuse in order to be inclusive." We haven't heard the elderly abuse mentioned. That's true. "The dangers to us are even greater. Senior buildings are poorly regulated by law. We need to both educate seniors better about signs of sexual abuse and warning them when they enter a facility." Another good point, and we appreciate both of those.
And that great point, I mean, there was a segment on NPR very recently that talked about sexual abuse happening in mental mm-hmm. health and mental mm-hmm. illness facilities. So I think all of those raise key questions that do need to be explored and explored in broader ways. And I'll just respond to the first person who offered a perspective that for me, when I'm talking about Black and brown bodies, I am being inclusive and I mm-hmm. am referring to all of those bodies that are not a part of what is considered the mainstream or dominant group in our in mm-hmm. American society in particular.
And mm-hmm. do you think most people, and this is a hard thing to answer, but I mean, when people talk about Black and brown bodies, are they talking about Native Americans and Asians in particular, or not even in particular, but you know, along with everybody else? Is there an equivalency? Is there a commonality for Asian American women and Black women? Elise Jalisi, what do you think?
Well, so at first I was like nodding, but then I kind of started shaking my head. And I think that, you know, the issue with, I think, these broad racial terms is that, you know, they don't really address, you know, how colorism and nationality play a role into how we identify and view other people. For example, I'm a non-Black woman, and when I, you know, check off, like, you know, my racial identification, I mark off Asian, but, you know, in most people's minds, when they think of Asian, they think of someone who might be from Far East Asia, like from Japan or China or Korea, but I'm actually Pakistani. And so, and, you know, my experiences and how I'm viewed because of, you know, my brown skin and my identity as a Muslim is probably very different from someone who is from another part of Asia that might not be Muslim and might not have brown skin. And so I think, you know, I think that depending on context, yes, sometimes the words, you know, Black and brown bodies can be inclusive, but I think, like I said, I think they fail to recognize the roles that colorism and nationality play into how we treat those bodies and how we regard them and the respect that we give to their narratives. Like, for example, the first comment that mentioned that we haven't talked about, you know, Native Americans and their experiences with sexual abuse and sexual assault and how their narratives might be different from Black folks, you know, I think that's a very valid point. And I wanted to add on something else for people that might be listening that identify as non-white and as non-Black, just like myself. And I really want to say that, you know, we shouldn't, you know, just like that first comment was mentioning, you know, we shouldn't view it as just a white or Black, the conversations around sexual assault is just a white or Black issue or white versus Black issue. You know, we as non-Black people of color, depending on, you know, a variety of other facets that we've mentioned, like gender identity and class and, you know, colorism and so on and so forth, do propagate anti-Blackness and do benefit from Black people's oppression. And there very much is a racial hierarchy that continues to persist in this country, as it has for hundreds of years. And so I'd really recommend, you know, us, and I'm especially speaking to like the South Asian community, you know, that does have, unfortunately, many anti-Black facets of its culture, to really take a look, you know, inward and think about how, yes, how we might be hurt by racism and classism, but also how we benefit from those very institutions, because it is a very complicated and messy dialogue.
Here's a couple more emails. I take hope, this comes from Rita, who says, I take hope in the Baltimore Women's March last Saturday. It was a wonderful melting pot of races, ages, and genders, both on stage and in the crowd. Lots of positivity and respect, and a great way to move forward with feminism in 2018. And one of our interns here at Midday is the editor of the Johns Hopkins newsletter. They were covering it. He was there. It was not his impression that it was a particularly diverse crowd. Were either of you guys there? Were any of you folks there?
That's why it wasn't diverse, because none of us were there.
So it's your fault.
No, and we weren't there for reasons.
Absolutely.
Right.
I actually, I mean, those types of events where women are being empowered, you know, I have an 11-year-old daughter, and so I want to create spaces where she feels welcome, where she feels central, and where she feels like she has support systems saying, we too support you. Mm-hmm. That was not such the case for mm-hmm. me. And that's why I chose not to take my daughter, and I put her in another space to spend the day where she was in such an environment. And so that was the same thing for the women's movement, mm-hmm. the Women's March the day after Trump's inauguration, that for me, those spaces, while we do see more diversity than we've seen in the past, and I have a number of Black feminist friends who will engage and who do participate wholeheartedly, and I support them, but in terms of it being a space where I feel like I am important, I have yet to have that feeling.
And Michelle sends an email that echoes this. She says, as an African-American, I'm definitely turned off by Me Too because I don't see the struggles of people of color mirrored in it. People of color and also women of low incomes have had to struggle with advances in rape as a means of survival to prevent us from losing our jobs and in some cases even our lives. So the Me Too movement definitely has class and race discrepancies. So mm-hmm. people agree about that. Is there then, Adar Ayira, the potential for coming together? I mean, you are feeling excluded. You are saying that the movement itself has done a lot to make you feel excluded. Is there a way of feeling included?
Well, I will say this, and I'm saying it about the ways that people sometimes feel when these issues come up, and why it is a good thing to really provide a frame or parameter for the conversation, because we all go into our feels, right? It's not about our feelings. It is about a system, and it is about a way of operating and a way of processing, and who is centered in that and who is not. So when we are talking about racism, white supremacy, when we're talking about gender violence, we are not only talking about incidents of, we're talking about the system that supports that. So instead of focusing on inclusion or diversity, how are we going to focus on issues relating to a system which does those things? So it's not about a march. It is about policies. What do those policies say? How are those policies implemented differently based on race or gender or your gender or sexual identity. These are the types of systemic issues that this conversation is really about.
Speaking of policy, Miranda joins us on the phone from Manchester, Maryland. I guess, Miranda, you have a question about policy. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. So, Alize Jalisi, what are some policy changes on the local, state, and federal level that should be enacted to educate allies and empower survivors of sexual assault in schools and in the workplace?
So, I'm going to speak from my perspective as like a college student, but certainly if the other folks in the room have brought more broader perspectives, and that would be amazing to add to it. I've been kind of thinking about how it's really important for colleges, including my own, Hopkins, you know, to really think about having student policies that center and place trust in the stories of survivors. So, for example, the guidelines that have been given in the Dear Colleague letters that advise how to carry out Title IX investigations, you know, I think are really important to continue to follow through with, despite Betsy DeVos's statements, you know, to rescind for colleges to rescind following those policies. And I know that Hopkins does continue to act in accordance with the Dear Colleague letters of 2011 and 2014, and also does carry out its investigations with, believing, you know, saying that the evidence should prove that more likely than not that the abuse or assault did occur, you know, rather than that's kind of like a preponderance of evidence rather than taking a necessity for a clear and convincing evidence approach in these investigations. So I think it's really important for colleges to continue to have those types of policies. And I think also to have policies and support systems in place that might provide legal assistance or personal or psychological counseling or any other sort of support for students who might not be able to afford that, for example, if they need it, or who might not be able to access it otherwise. I think universities should enact policies to do that as well.
And Kimberly Moffitt, I was taken by an essay in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago by a woman named Lindy West, who says, you know, I sit on all these all-female panels in front of all-female audiences and talk about how to fix gender bias, you know? And the title of this piece was, Why Is It Our Responsibility to Fix the System That Victimizes Us? Is this a man problem? We talked about, you know, feeling excluded by women, the white women, middle-class women in the women's movement, but is it fundamentally a male problem, or is it an admixture of all of the above?
Yeah, it's a societal problem. Mm-hmm. It's something that requires all of us to be at the table in order to address. It's not magically going to erase and disappear just by having a bunch of men in a room to fix it. If anything, that's just going to create another system of oppression that looks very different than the one that we currently have. And so I would say it requires all of us to be at the table to figure out what we have been doing wrong in our society that does further victimize victims who come forward regarding sexual harassment, but also at the same time teaches the next generation behind us. I have a 13-year-old son. I have these conversations now about how he needs to treat women, how he sees his dad treat his mom, what he needs to do once, and I'm speaking specifically because of what he professes to be his orientation, what he plans to do to speak to a woman that he is interested in, and how you don't speak to such a woman. Because we are in a very hypersexual society where so many of our children are being exposed to messages very early that I think we do ourselves a disservice as a society waiting until we get to college and have these conversations when all of the messages of how we're supposed to interact with and treat each other have already been established well before then. So if anything, we're working against the grain at that point if we wait until they're 17, 18 years old.
Well, this has been a terrific conversation. I very much appreciate all of you being involved, and we will continue to have this conversation for as long as this problem persists, and my guess is it's going to persist long after all of us are gone, but we will still, that ain't going to stop us talking about it. All right. Alize Jalisi is a student at Johns Hopkins University and the president of Hopkins Feminists. Dr. Kimberly Moffitt is an assistant professor of Africana Studies at UMBC. She studies subjects ranging from black hair to body politics to Disney movies. And Adar Ayira is the co-founder of Baltimore Racial Justice Action and the program director at Associated Black Charities. Coming up after a break, theater critic J. Wynn Russick joins us with her weekly theater review. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Stay with us.